I moved here in the winter of 1995.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Wendy Chaptis, right. Wendy Chaptis. I moved here in the winter of 1995 to start working at USM. And I had been teaching at the University of California, Santa Cruz before that as a graduate student. And one of the classes that I had developed there was a queer politics class that I sort of taught all of the most explosive issues in queer politics of the early 90s. And so there was a whole segment on public sex. There was a segment on the feminist sex debates, intergenerational sex, I mean, all of the hot button issues. And then I got the job in Maine, and it was a women's studies and a sociology job, and I had to start teaching suddenly three classes a semester, and I had to develop them all brand new. And I thought, well, at least I have this one class I've taught before. And it had been a big lecture class to like 120 students in Santa Cruz. So I thought, well, I'll just repackage it a little bit. I knew it was a little much my very first semester of my very first real job to teach queer politics. But I thought I could like tweak it a little bit and do it as sociology of sexuality. So I did that, and it was this, instead of 120-person lecture class, there were like, I don't know, 8 or 10 students who were brave enough to sign up for it. And we read Pat Califia's Public Sex. And I was watching the stories develop at that time around this, what seemed to me, this crazed police chief, Mike Chitwood, who was, you know, arresting people for having sex in the fine arts cinema. I mean, it was a porn theater, you know, and they were having sex. Like, what, they were, somebody was masturbating and you were going to be pissed off because they were masturbating next to you while you're watching a porn movie? You know, it was crazy. So I was having the students read the newspaper articles, and I then had the flash that I would invite Chitwood to my class to talk to them. And he accepted, of course, because, you know, he loved to talk. And he came, and they had read Pat Califia's book, and he did his little song and dance about, he started it off by talking about a sting he had done on the Western prom, where he had called all the media together, and he had gotten those big, you know, spotlight things, and he was going to shine them down on the, you know, the bushes of the Western prom, and they had a couple of cops already positioned. They were going to, like, literally beat the bushes to get the gay men to come out and then be filmed on TV because he had invited the media and the press. So he started the lecture in my class, or the talk to my class, off with this anecdote, and he was sort of telling it in a self-deprecating way because the fact of the matter was he had organized this whole thing, and they were beating the bushes, and there were no gay men that came out, and so it was a kind of a big flop, and he looked around, and no one was laughing. I mean, people were horrified. There was this, you did what? And then one of the young gay men in my class, you know, just really jumped on him about, you know, who was he protecting, and why was this, you know, a police priority. And then another student asked him about the fine arts cinema arrests, and I mean, the guy just looked stunned. Like, he had not expected this at all. So that was my introduction to Portland and public sex. And the story goes on from there, but I'll turn it over to Erica for her first bit of the story.
Okay. I'm Erica Rand, and my relation to that story is I moved to Maine, Lewiston, actually, in 1990. And when those incidents at the State Theater were happening, I was also writing a sex advice column for this radical queer journal, Apex. And there was a lot of complicated debate at that journal about what the deal was. And in fact, one of my sexual partners at the time said to me, I need you to tell me what's wrong with my view, but, you know, I can't stand the idea that guys get to whip their dick out anywhere in public, and I want you to tell me, like, I know something's wrong with that, and you're going to tell me what's wrong with that. And I said, well, you know, for one thing, is it really that different from when you fucked me up against a lighthouse at a public park on a Sunday afternoon when all sorts of people were going by and she had to pause and think, oh, really, you know, it's not necessarily so different. And I think it's sort of important because part of the issue, I think, for a lot of people was this combination of how do you understand things like public sex in relation to other formations of power and privilege. But so that was kind of my part of my place in thinking about those issues and also watching sort of horrified as the news was coming on in Chitwood, who not only was doing that stuff, but was also trying to do things like arrest people for redistributing pharmaceutical drugs after they died of AIDS so other people could have them. So he was going after, you know, ridiculous, crazed media things that were just inhumane in a lot of ways. So eventually, Wendy and I both got involved in this group of concerned people who kept changing our names to try to get a good acronym, but I think we wound up calling ourselves People Against Police Harassment, which doesn't actually stand
poof.
For anything.
No, we said it was poof. Poof. Like, you know, like the...
Right. Like poof-ter. Right. Yes. So People Against Police Harassment that had about 8 or 10 people who came frequently, and they included someone from the ACLU. They included a guy who I think was at the time was an alderman, city councilor, was he something, who had had the experience, who had come to this issue of cruising in particular because he had been driving through Deering Oaks Park with his 12-year-old son and had been stopped for a broken taillight, and the cop had said to him, "Can you tell me what this young man is doing in your car?" And he said, "I'm taking him to the mall to get sneakers or something." But then he was horrified that he had to then explain to the kid why somebody was asking him that question, and he was involved. We had probably 4 or 5 other people and did a variety of things like make up little things to give out to people that told them what their rights were and procedures they might take in case they got arrested. And what else?
Okay, so let's see what else. Okay, well, for me, meanwhile, the story picks up. So I'm doing all of this with Erica and others. And I have invited Chitwood to my class, and so I know he already knows who I am and probably is not really happy with me anymore. And I decide as... and he's not only going after men having sex in public or even in the semi-private of a porn theater. He's also trying to get the city council to pass laws that would prevent people from loitering in public. You know, so you, if you could be down in the Old Port, as long as you had an ice cream cone in your hand or a cup of Starbucks or you had a bag that suggested you were shopping, but you couldn't just sit on a curb or on a bench and hang out.
Well, but can I say the 1993-ish or whenever that photo is from the Casco Bay Weekly, that was a photo of all these people from ACT UP just sitting on a fire escape when somebody called the police because we weren't shopping and said that we would be arrested if we didn't immediately disperse for sitting.
Right.
So it wasn't official, but people were still moving that non-law before he came along to publicize.
So probably, you know, it was something that he expected he could get the council to move on. And the way he presented it was that these were socially undesirable elements who were hanging out and, you know, making the Old Port and other areas less desirable to those who would be engaged in proper activity. So there was that. There was an anti-skateboarding element, too, where he was trying to get legislation passed to prohibit skateboarding and then the public sex. So I thought, coming from sort of a queer nation background when I was in California, I thought of immediately doing stickers of some sort. And so in October, it was Halloween, and I thought, great, I will dress up as a cop. And I made up these stickers that said, they were bright pink, and they said, warning, this is a designated socially undesirable person. This person has committed one or more of the following offenses: sex, skateboarding, sitting in public. And I was going to, you know, sticker people. And a couple of days before the queer party that was held, like the Halloween party in the Holiday Inn by the Bay, I got a call from one of my colleagues telling me that another one of my colleagues at the university had been arrested for having, or at least taking photos, lewd photos of underage girls in his university office. And our workplace had become a crime zone, and there were, you know, police everywhere, and computers were being seized, and...
Because he'd used his computer.
He had used his computer to store the images. He hadn't done anything else with them, but he had stored them on his work computer. Yes. Smart. So Chitwood, of course, was standing on the steps of my building at the university giving press conferences, saying things like, you know, this was a kiddie porn on the internet issue. And I thought suddenly my costume was in very bad taste as a member of that department. Here I was going to, you know, go out and talk about, well, the rest of the thing I was handing out read. These were the little flyers that went with the sticker. Are you now or have you ever been a socially undesirable person? I have taken up space on the sidewalks of downtown Portland without being engaged in proper consumer activity. I have had sex in places other than in the privacy of the marital bedroom. I have dressed in fashions that suggest dominance or submission without actually being a member of the Portland Police Department or a criminal in custody. If you have answered yes to any of these above questions, you are a designated threat to the social order. Immediately provide the Portland Police Department with a list of all businesses you routinely patronize. These establishments must be closely monitored for evidence that they are attracting a socially undesirable element and will face the loss of their business licenses. Thank you for your cooperation. So this was my fabulous Halloween costume that suddenly became entirely inappropriate. And I didn't wear it and I didn't use it. But I still had all these fabulous stickers and citations to hand out, so that by the time Gay Pride rolled around in June and the scandal surrounding my colleague had somewhat resolved itself, he had been convicted and we had moved on, I resurrected them and dressed as a police officer that Pride and handed them out.
One of the things that happened a lot in the early 90s was that people, and mid-90s, was that officials who were trying to take some kind of action, whether good or bad, learned about things like homo hatred by becoming victims of it. So, you know, even the people who tried to, the mayor and police chief who tried to push forward a anti-discrimination ordinance in Lewiston without actually doing any, you know, research about whether there was a voter base of any kind, were stunned to have, you know, threats of violence directed against them and their families and stuff. So I can imagine, you know, certain kind of naive behavior from every angle.
What I do remember is when this law was, this no cruising law and related ordinances were being discussed in front of the city council, I went to testify, and I think Charlie Harlow was a city council person at that time, because I remember him saying that he thought this might be a good idea to prohibit cruising, for instance, on the Western Prom, because he could imagine how unsafe women would feel if they were walking along, you know, the prom or through the park, and suddenly, you know, people were having sex or people were there looking for sex. And I remember saying to him, I lived right on the Western Prom. I lived on the top floor of that apartment building at the end of the Western Prom at the time. And I remember saying to him, but, you know, that's when I feel the safest. I mean, if I walk out at night and there are people out there and I know there are men who are looking to have sex with men, as a woman, I feel like, good, there are people around and they're not going to harass me. And he just looked stunned. I mean, it was like he had never thought through the issue at all.
Yeah, and the Western prom and the Eastern prom both look remarkably different than they did 10, 20, 30 years ago in terms of the deforestation that's happened. Is that recognizable to you as well?
Oh, absolutely.
And I imagine Deering Oaks maybe similarly?
Deering Oaks, I think, just sort of got cleaned up because I hear it was really neglected. I think with the Western prom and the Eastern prom, though, you're absolutely right. And it was clearing out places that people could be invisible to have sex or could live, you know, as the economy tanked. It was also, you know, make sure nobody is living in the brush. I don't think it was all about gay sex either. I mean, I think
for sure.
Parkside, certainly, the reason that there were no cruising signs all over Parkside is it was the prostitution center. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mellon Street was the stroll. So, you know, Chitwood was certainly concerned about gay men having sex, public sex, but he was also concerned about heterosexual men cruising for sex workers.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, why Parkside was targeted.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was going to say the noticeable difference in the sign from West End, Parkside, and East End is in the East End, all the no's in no cruising is spray painted out on every single sign. So it seemed like there was some sort of organized resistance to it. And I guess I'm wondering to hear more about sort of people organizing. Because I know it happened in Parkside and West End first. And then 2 or 3 years later started happening in East End. And I'm wondering if there was more organized resistance to it since the people had already seen it happen in one part of town.
Yeah, we stickered them. I can't remember what we stickered them with anymore, but when they went up, they got stickered.
And what about that big, what was that big sign? That big flashing sign on the...
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't there on the Eastern prom, was it the police that put up a big flashing sign for once? Like some...
God, yeah, I'm vaguely
You know, there was some gigantic, like
that.
A flashing, you know, like a...
No cruising sign.
Right, the sign that would ordinarily say something like, construction begins Monday, seek alternate route, with that kind of a sign. There was some giant sign on the Eastern prom.
I think it did say no cruising or something like that.
Some crazy. There was some kind of action about that. I don't remember it. I remember we were at it, but I don't remember what we did. But I can just vaguely picture this sign. Flashing.
Huh. And it's interesting to you because the rhetoric of Chitwood and sort of the like public, the official public record, like there's some really wacky statements about like air quality control and like, you know, making sure like children had safe streets to walk on because there weren't cars driving around all the time.
Oh.
And it's really interesting to see that rhetoric versus, like, the letters to the editors that were like, I don't want those faggots having sex in my yard. Then versus, so there's, like, the official record, which was, like, mired in all sorts of, like, you know, bullshit. And then there was, like, the sort of heterosexual landowners being like, we don't want these faggots having sex in our yard. And then there was also an interesting, like, a good gay versus bad gay dialogue that was happening, and I was wondering if you could speak to that, maybe, of people saying, basically people saying, oh, this is a public health crisis, this isn't a gay issue, this is a public health issue, and that was, like, one of the letters to the editor that was from a gay man that was like, this isn't about being gay, this is about HIV and safety, so I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, if you recall any of that back and forth.
Well, I would just say mostly about the context is that because the early through mid-90s were also the years of anti-gay referenda. There was huge concern in a ton of contexts about whether or not gay people were representing themselves as the, you know, good, law-abiding, interested in marriage people we now see all over the place as theoretically representing us. So I'm sure that that was a central, you know, we don't want people to think that that's what we do. Also, in 1993-ish, 3-4, when the Lewiston Ordinance was happening, you know, people got copied. That's when that anti-gay, the gay agenda so-called documentary came out that was 30 minutes that started with the Pride Parade in San Francisco or New York footage and this sort of right-wing approach of describing public sexual behavior of any kind as the norm. So I think lots of people were very interested in we don't look like that, but also interested in we don't look like those ACT UP people and we don't look like those people with the green hair and, you know, things of that nature.
What was funny for me is, as I said, I had just moved here from California. And with my, actually I was alone most of the time, but my very wild girlfriend would come out periodically. And I'm sure there I was, I'm teaching a class, you know, at USM that's about public sex and SM and things. So I must have been one of those people that arrived and the people that you're talking about went, oh, fuck. But because I was that person, I didn't really, I mean, nobody knew me anyway, so I didn't have a community already to scandalize or something. And I quickly met people like Erica, so I thought, oh, good. I've landed in a, you know, in a part of the world where there's sex radicals and it's all good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm wondering, too, if you can speak to, like, the role of, I guess I see, like, a number of parallel things happening at once, where, like, the first gay rights laws, like, non-discrimination laws are sort of, like, gaining traction, late 80s, early 90s, and then, you know, the HIV AIDS narrative is happening at the same time with, like, radical direct action, and then at this, and I see another parallel track with the ultra-conservative right using public sex, radical, like, direct action activists as a way to repeal and turn back all these pretty mainstream, now mainstream ideas of, like, equality and protection from by the state and whatever. And I guess I'm particularly interested in, yeah, how the right had mobilized HIV and public sex cultures as, like, ultra dangerous and, like, an attack on the family. Because I guess, I'm sort of getting to a long roundabout way to get to, like, sort of one of my core hypotheses is about the possibility for intergenerational queer contact to be happening in cruising spaces and how that sort of intergenerational contact that's based on pleasure as opposed to fear of the stranger. It's like seeing the stranger as a site of potential pleasure. And how that sort of, like, challenges our notion of, like, queer sociality and what we define as family and how relationships can be really complicated and different, particularly where youth are seen as not having agency over their own sexuality. Like, a lot of the people I previously interviewed were, like, talking about cruising at, like, 14 and 15 and 16, where it was actually legal for them to be having sex. So I guess I see, I'm seeing sort of, like, the rights mobilization around, like, stranger danger, predators, being highly mobilized to detract from any sort of, like, mainstream gay rights movement and how public sex got, like, drawn into that as, like, emblematic of why the gays need to, like, disappear or be erased.
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess, I don't know, I guess I'm looking for, like, maybe more examples of things that were happening that were being mobilized by, like, say, the Christian Civic League or not necessarily just, like, the police chief, or if that was happening at all.
Okay, well, I think, to me, one thing I'd like to say about the Christian Civic League and organizations like that that just needs to be said in terms of this whole issue, not so much about sex, is that one thing that happened, good thing that happened, or whatever, is that for me, in the middle of all this, I made a contact, or actually became lovers with somebody who was able to score me a copy of the Christian Civic League Organizing Handbook. And I think something really important is that they were fucking great organizers. I mean, and I just think that's really important to say, because it's not just about, like, what are they targeting and what's wrong with what they're targeting, but in terms of political movement, they had an incredible, like, they had an organization method that was as good as the Chicago Democratic machine, which, you know, is, like, as good as you can get, I think. And from that angle, they were kind of in all sorts of places doing different kinds of things, and also not only presenting queer people and gay people as sexual predators going after your kids, trying to infiltrate the schools, but also this idea, very, very powerful here and in lots of other places, of that gay people had more money and a bigger income. And there was this one broadside that kept getting put out as if it were local, but it came from a national organization. But you could see the same one in Florida, in Maine, in, you know, all over the place. That was about, you know, not only are they having sex with your children, but they have all these frequent flyer miles and this, like, just list of things that were really trying to get to this kind of panic that was also about, I don't have a job, and these are people who might be taking my jobs and doing work and sucking up all this economic prosperity. That's ironic compared to, or considering what Wendy was talking about in terms of Chitwood's idea of you need to be buying things in order to be legitimate on the streets, because there's, again, in this different twisty way, so many things that are about, you know, what is the economy that we're living in and how do you envision it and how can you really use it to scare people.
The thing, though, that struck me about the Christian Civic League, this was not the shop that was run by Michael Heath, but the head of it was Paul Volley. I think that was his name. That was the other person I invited to one of my classes at USM when I first started teaching there. It was a critical thinking about social issues class, and we were using the anti-discrimination law as a issue. And I invited, because I was out in the classroom, I thought, well, I should invite somebody from, quote, the other side to come in and present their perspective. And he did. And I was astonished at what an equal opportunity bigot he was. I mean, he stood up there and he told students that he'd come from the South, so he had worked with black people, and that they actually really were, you know, less inclined to work hard. And so, well, you know, it would, like, these anti-discrimination laws that required people to hire people of other races, you know, it all seemed like a good idea, but in fact, it meant that he would have to hire people that weren't as good of workers. And that, you know, laws that protected Jews, after all, you know, Jews had killed Jesus. And I mean, it was just like, and I was flabbergasted that this was the head of, and he was also sort of an unattractive person. I mean, his energy and his physique.
He wasn't hot.
So, you know, in terms of marketing, I don't know, I just thought, this is the person who represents this organization. And in fact, they got rid of him, and, you know, it morphed into the Michael Heath show, where they had a young, you know, conventionally attractive man who turned out to also put his foot in his mouth a lot, but seemed more slick, at least initially.
The Christian Civic League Organizing Handbook, by the way, has a thing where basically it's explaining how the man should be in charge of the family, and basically says we can't follow all the laws in the Bible anymore because, for instance, slavery has been outlawed. Thus, but we still can follow the principle that, you know, the man should have power over the woman, and that, you know, a boss should have power over his employee, which is how you would translate the slavery thing since the law in the country prohibits it. So it was actually quite interesting.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah. Just a little side historical.
But you're right. I mean, there was a huge, it was a very fraught political moment in this country, and certainly in the state of Maine, around deviance, you know, and particularly sexual deviants. So, you know, those of us who were really reveling in being deviant and had a really profound critique of normalcy, you know, we were, I'm sure, you know, we were the yin to that yang or whatever. We were really the other side of it. I mean, Volley was right to look at me and, you know, be horrified just as I was looking at him.
I guess I'm interested in your thoughts about sort of like contemporary sexual cultures.
There needs to be more dyke public sex culture. I mean, there just needs to be more.
Yeah, I mean, when I mean, I imagine there is in some places. Yeah. When I was in the San Francisco area before I moved here, it was a sort of heyday of sex parties, and you know, it was part of the circle of people that I was in at that time. Like Dorothy Allison and Pat Califia would organize sex parties in the city, and there was God, what was it called? There's some organization that organized these massive sex parties. They rented a kind of swingers hotel in the East Bay of San Francisco. It was, you know, across the bay from San Francisco, and you know, hundreds of women came. But you know, we not only need more venues, we need socialization that allows it to happen. Because I remember being at this giant sex party, hundreds of women. All we are there to do is have sex, and we're crammed into small spaces and passing each other, and people are going, "Excuse me, excuse me."
Oh,
yeah.
I called the police department to sort of chat with them about. I posed as a reporter for the Phoenix.
Good job.
And they were very they bent over backwards to help me. It was kind of funny, but I you know, I'm writing a story about, you know, cruising, and you know, like, this used to be a hot button issue, and you know, the signs are still up all over town. I was wondering if you could let me know, like, how many people have been had a citation of cruising in the last, you know, 10 years or so. And he was like, he responded really funny. He was like, "Cruising, you know, like, you know, people do that online now." And
you know, like, I know too.
Yeah, oh no, they totally
they probably
know.
Have a computer.
That's good.
And I you know, I like had to play it cool, and I was like, well, you know, that's sort of my hypothesis, you know, like blah 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 for the story. But yeah, I was wondering if I could come down to the criminal records division and sort of like look through, or if you had any information. He's like, yeah, like let me do it. I'll give you a call back and give me a day, whatever. Call me back the next day, and he was like, yeah, no one's been arrested in 10 years. There was one citation, and it was drug related in Parkside. But he said in 96, there was 11 arrests within 3 days in October.
That was it.
You know, so it's obvious that it was like big sting operation, scare a bunch of people, and then people will police themselves. You know, it's like...
You know, you just mentioned that he said there had been a citation or arrest or whatever, and it was in Parkside, and it was drug-related. That's the other thing to remember. So it's partly... especially in this neighborhood, it's partly a law that allows them to crack down on prostitution, and it's also a law that allows them to crack down on drugs.
Yeah. But I guess, I just thought it was, I think it's interesting that the police department know that it's shifted to sort of like this digital public.
Totally.
And I think the recent sort of crackdowns, and it's mostly been focused on prostitution, and particularly female prostitutes, via Craigslist being busted in sting operations by the police across New England. Like, that was like 2 or 3 years ago they started doing that like pretty regularly. I guess I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, like, I feel like the public sex culture is always one step ahead of the law in terms of like how it's policed. And I know, yeah, like, I guess I'm wondering how the police department is going to follow up with this now, like, sort of digital public cruising, and what sort of methods of control or laws are going to be made. And I guess some of it comes from more nefarious ways of like installing software on public library computers that don't allow you to go to any site that has the word gay in its keywords, or, you know, sort of things like that that are sort of like this soft coercion that isn't as visible.
But, you know, the other thing that you have to remember is they are probably less interested in policing the invisible sex. I mean, the sex that's happening in people's apartments. Not that they don't want laws against it, because it's very handy to have, you know, to be able to criminalize a whole bunch of people in case you want to arrest them for something. But it's like prostitution. People who work in the indoor trade don't get arrested very often. It's nice to have the law. You can use it when you want it. But really, the people who get busted are the street prostitutes. And I think the same thing is true cruising. If they can get people to move indoors and do it all on computer and in their own homes, you know, that's great. That makes deviance invisible.
And it also goes back to the example that you gave before this interview of distinguishing between having public sex because you want to have sex, meet people, whatever, outside or in some public place, and doing it because you don't have a choice, right? And it seems connected also to that idea that a lot of laws are basically always designed, you know, they may state one thing, but they're designed to, you know, enable you to do a bunch of other things. So, as Wendy said, they're policing a bunch of different kinds of things. And so many ways that people want to be made deviant to, you know, really get at some other thing. And so much of it, I don't know, it reminds me of these long ago Ellis Island laws about how you needed $25 to get into the country, which was a big amount of money. And the commissioner who was, you know, put that law in place just said, really, hey, how can we keep out Jews and Italians? I know. Let's make them pay. And he could just really say that, but it's just as typical of how many laws there are that are, you know, ostensibly about one thing, but they're really about something else, even if it's about keeping things indoors or something. So that question of what people want to, one, what they want to police, and two, what they want to have as an option to use, which, as you remember, that's where Bowers v. Hardwick came from. You know, the law happened to be there against sodomy, then you could use it.
Right.